there's a disconnect between what people read in the statute book as being applicable law and what the law is as the Supreme Court has stated it.
The Board of Game meets to deal with contentious hunting issues. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 8th of October. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Cook Inlet beluga numbers are up slightly, but the outlook is still bleak.
It's more likely that it's going to continue to decline than to recover at this point.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
New numbers are out from the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration show more Cook Inlet beluga whale were counted this year compared to 2009. But as KDLL's Ben Stanton reports, that number does not tell the whole story.
The estimate this year is 340 whales. That's 19 more whales than last year's estimate. This annual count will lead scientists to predict the probability of the species' recovery and the probability of a decline into eventual extinction. Although an updated figure is yet to be calculated for this year, the past shows a trend.
It's more likely that it's going to continue to decline than to recover at this point.
Rob Hobbs is a leader of the Beluga Project at the National Marine Mammal Laboratory in Seattle. That office does research relating to NOAA and the National Marine Fisheries Service. He says in previous year's data, it's shown a 70% chance of continued decline in the whale's population and a 5 to 10% chance of a sustainable recovery. The last decade has stayed at a population decline of 1.1%. Hobbs says they have several models that take into account the sex and age of the animals to better determine their future. So why does this year's increase in estimates not indicate a recovery? Well, it involves a range of statistical variation for each year's estimates. That overwhelms what some years appears to be a significant jump in the population.
It appears that from 2009 to 2010 there was an increase that falls well within the statistical variation of those two times. So then to get a trend from this whole time period, we fit a line to those numbers.
That's sometimes called a line of best fit, and the statistical range puts the estimates at plus or minus 70 whales. To do the counts, Hobbs says first NOAA takes 5 or 6 trips in the Upper Cook Inlet over 2 weeks in early June. Both aerial observation and video recording review are used to count the whales.
Most of the surveys are of the upper inlet. They go from Anchorage around Chicoloon Bay up Turnagain Arm down to Kenai and then across and back up the west side to Beluga River, Susitna River, and then up Kinnick Arm to complete the counts.
Then the lower Cook Inlet is studied over about a 2-day period. Funding for the study comes through the federal government. The state of Alaska filed a lawsuit in June seeking to overturn the listing of beluga whales on the endangered species list. After that, environmental groups in Alaska themselves have sought to challenge the state lawsuit. Local governments like the Kenai Peninsula Borough Mayor's Office have sought independent studies of what's causing the decline in the whales. Opponents of the listing say that they're worried about potential negative side effects of yet unknown federal regulations that would hurt the oil and gas industry and plans to expand the Port of Anchorage along with other projects. Some estimates from the late 1970s have the Cook Inlet beluga population at 1,300. Subsistence hunting of the whales by Alaska natives was heavily restricted starting in 1999. In Kenai, I'm Ben Stanton.
The state's game board sat down today for a special meeting in Anchorage to deal with the contentious issue of the future of the Nelchina caribou hunt in Game Management Unit 13. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The State Board of Game spent the morning hours listening to staff reports regarding Nelchina herd management, health, and hunting violation enforcement. The Nelchina caribou hunt has been plagued with legal issues. This summer, an Alaska Superior Court judge, Kenai's Carl Bowman, ruled last year's Tier 1 subsistence hunt and a first-time Otna community harvest illegal on constitutional grounds. Later, the same judge allowed the Tier 1 fall hunt to continue on a limited basis and allowed community harvest permit holders to participate in a Tier 2 hunt for the winter season. This session, the Board of Game must deal with setting hunting regulations for the Game Management Unit 13 caribou hunt that stand up to legal disputes. That may prove challenging. Kevin Saxby with the State Department of Law told the board that the law requires the panel to consider a number of criteria to determine who is a subsistence user and how much of the harvestable surplus of the herd's population can be provided for subsistence use. But he said the panel needs to also consider the case laws which have impacted the state's subsistence statute.
The 92 version of the law is the law that we continue to have. And some of the rulings have effectively stricken portions of that law. The legislature's never gone back and amended the law to reflect those rulings. And so there's a disconnect between what people read in the statute book as being the applicable law and what the law is as the Supreme Court has stated it.
The hunt's legal woes intensified when the Alaska Outdoor Council joined a suit filed by Kasilof's Kenneth Manning, which challenged last year's Otna community hunt, claiming the community hunt created two types of subsistence user. Saxby said how the state's subsistence law has been interpreted has been confusing since the 1989 McDowell decision.
You'll see that it, quote, subsistence uses means the non-commercial, customary, and traditional uses of wild, renewable resources by a resident domiciled in a rural area of the state. Well, that's the law, right? In 1989, in the McDowell case, the Alaska Supreme Court struck that word from this definition. They said you can't, it's unconstitutional to have rural there. And yet the legislature's never altered the definition. It's still there. It's still on the books. And no other entity can do it. It's the legislature that writes the law. That disconnect can only be corrected by the legislature.
Saxby told the board that they would have to decide on which level of abundance the herd stands at now. The highest level would provide a surplus for all user groups, while the lowest level would provide for Tier 1 subsistence users only. State Fish and Game biologist Becky Schwanke told the board that the department wants to bring the herd to a level of 40,000 animals to sustain harvests of at least 1,500 surplus animals each year. Schwanke said fall estimates put the herd at about 45,000 animals this year due to high calving rates this spring. Saxby told the board they must determine what level of surplus is available and provide reasonable hunting opportunity for eligible user groups. The board hears public testimony on the Nelchina caribou issue through today and Saturday. The panel has added black bear trapping, predator control, and wolf and bear management items to the special meeting agenda. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, gauging the interest in a road to Nome.
Some people who choose to live where they live because there is not road access, and so it's important that we be able to talk to those people too and get their input.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Northern Air Cargo. For over 54 years, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
It was political hoopla in Bethel this weekend when politicians flew in for the premier political event in the YK Delta. The Association of Village Council Presidents hosted their 46th annual convention. The event brings together delegates from 56 tribes throughout the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta, making it the ideal location for candidates to get some face time with rural leaders. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson reports on how the three-way race for Senate is shaping up in the YK Delta.
During a busy lunch hour, supporters of Republican Senator Lisa Murkowski staked out the busiest intersection in town to show their support for the write-in candidate. Murkowski spent 2 days in Bethel during this pivotal week for state politics. After leading a roundtable discussion on suicide, Murkowski got busy campaigning. She spent much of her time blasting the Republican nominee.
The proposals that Joe Miller has set forth in terms of reductions to federal spending, in terms of not only one, but two pledges to eliminate all earmarks would be devastating for this region. Just devastating.
In an area of the state heavily dependent on federal funding, Murkowski told voters that she will protect vital programs and funding if she's put back into office. And she raised questions about whether or not Miller would do the same. She singled out the Denali Commission, which is federal money designated for transportation and infrastructure like village health clinics.
Every year, the delegation has to work to insert those dollars, and those are earmarked dollars, whether it's for the transportation piece, whether it's for the clinic piece.
Miller was not on hand for the convention. Instead, his campaign is contacting radio stations in hopes of getting some airtime in some of the farther corners of the state. In an interview with KYUK, Miller refuted claims that he'll aim at turning off the federal spigot right away.
Let me make this abundantly clear. You elect Joe Miller, this is not in any question a cut to Denali Commission. In other words, I'm not going to get elected and say no more to Denali Commission.
But Miller says that there should be a transition away from federal spending for programs like the Denali Commission. He says over time, that money should instead be generated through natural resource development in the state.
There are jobs that you can create close to the tundra. I mean, whether it be through hydrocarbons, you know, you look at, and of course, some of these things like the shale oil development, of course, there's some controversy with it. Ultimately, assuming that that's done in an environmentally sound way, you got a 400-mile pipeline that's going to be created across the tundra.
Meanwhile, Democratic candidate Scott McAdams came to Bethel in hopes of making a big first impression.
My name's Scott McAdams. I'm the mayor of the city and borough of Sitka. I am a big guy from a rural Alaska community.
Still relatively unknown, McAdams was not scheduled to speak, but AVCP delegates carved out a few moments for him to present his views. He wasted no time positioning himself as a hardline supporter of Alaska tribes.
It is time once and for all that we have a federal delegation that believes that Alaska's 229 federally recognized tribes be considered sovereign.
With the whirlwind tours now over, YK Delta voters will have to watch the rest of the campaign through media and campaign ads. I'm Shane Iverson.
Petersburg bars, restaurants, clubs, workplaces, and public spaces will all have to be smoke-free in less than a month. Matt Lichtenstein has a follow-up to this week's vote.
For many longtime smokers, there's a powerful connection between having a drink and having a cigarette.
As soon as you light up or take a swallow of a drink, you light up a cigarette. It's just that way.
Over an afternoon drink and a smoke at the Harbor Bar, customer Mike Robison considers how things may change once Petersburg's smoking ban goes into effect. Robison was against the measure. He expects old-timers like himself will still come to the bar for a coffee or a drink in the daytime, especially when the weather gets bad, but he thinks there'll be a different customer base at night.
Your entire evening shift is going to be a lot younger crowd, the ones that grew up without smoking.
In general, opponents of the ban, smokers and non-smokers, had argued that these rules should be left up to individual business owners. When the ban was initially proposed by the city council, local bar owners were worried about losing customers. However, a couple agreed to take part in a committee that revised and shaped the final measure, which ultimately passed this month. Harbor Bar co-owner Darcy Caples was on that committee, and she wasn't surprised by the election results. Caples is staying positive about the whole thing.
I'm not really that bummed about it. I think we'll just all make the most of it. I'm hoping to get more customers from it and just on to bigger and better things, I think.
Proponents of the smoking ban stress the need to protect employees from having to work in smoky environments like the bars. Mayor Al Dwyer was pleased that the vote margin was so substantial in favor of the measure.
I thought it was going to be more like, you know, 51-50 or so, a 49 or something like that. But I'm proud of the people of Petersburg for stepping up to the plate. It took some doing, some courage, and most everybody kept quiet about the whole thing and just allowed the public to stew about it in their own minds and make their own decisions. So I'm proud of them.
One of the most prominent anti-smoking groups in town is the Petersburg Indian Association. Among other efforts over the past several years, the tribal government has run general public service announcements on the radio about the dangers of smoking and secondhand smoke. Tribal Administrator Will Ware says grant funding rules prevent the PIA from campaigning specifically on the smoking ordinance, but he sees its passage as a positive sign for the town.
Well, we're just excited about it. It's a good ordinance, and I think that there's some challenges with it, but overall, it's a step in the right direction.
It's now up to the city to enforce the new rules. City Manager Scott Hahn does not think it will be too big of a problem.
This
something that's fairly common across the country. And here in Petersburg, it passed almost 2-1. So I think even those that do patronize the public places are probably going to want to make sure that smoking doesn't occur. So I really don't think there'll be much of a problem.
The American Cancer Society had a mixed reaction to the Petersburg vote. The group's Cancer Action Network lobbies for smoke-free laws at the local, state, and national level. Alaska Government Relations Director Emily Neenan commends Petersburg's anti-smoking education efforts and says the Cancer Society is pleased with most of what made it into the ordinance, but she adds the group is concerned about provisions allowing businesses to have separately ventilated smoking rooms.
Smoking rooms and ventilation do not protect people from secondhand smoke. The one thing that can be said about ventilation systems is that they're wildly expensive and completely inadequate, because they don't remove carcinogens, they can't protect people from secondhand smoke.
For now, at least, some bar owners don't seem inclined to use this option. Harbor Bar co-owner Darcy Caples thinks the state could eventually end up imposing stricter regulations anyway.
And so we probably won't go into building a room like that if we're not going to be able to use it. So there's a few things we'd probably like to check into before we consider that.
Over at Petersburg's other public bar, Keto's Cave, General Manager Hillary Whitethorn has a similar take on the issue.
It's something we've talked about, but we need to see what our numbers do first. Maybe our numbers will grow, maybe they won't. I don't know what will happen, so we just have to wait and see.
Whitethorn points out that prior to this vote, there were a lot of people in town who said they did not come to the bar because of the smoke. She hopes these folks and other new customers will come to the bar after November 1st, when all the town's businesses and public spaces go smoke-free. In Petersburg, I'm Matt Lichtenstein.
The U.S. Arctic Research Commission is wrapping up 3 days of meetings at the University of Alaska Fairbanks today. The commission sets goals for allocation of hundreds of millions of dollars in annual funding. Acting Commission Chair UAF Professor Buck Sharpton is one of three Alaskans on the 7-member panel, with the other four from Oregon, Virginia, Massachusetts, and New York. UAF-based scientists are presenting their work to the Arctic Research Commission. Associate Professor of Arctic Biology Sindonia Bratt-Hart spoke on projects going on at the university's Tulik Station on the North Slope, including the landscape's response to an unprecedented wildfire in 2007. The Anaktuvik River Fire, the largest tundra blaze ever recorded on the North Slope, burned 400 square miles in the summer and fall of 2007. Bratt-Hart says the burn area has greened up, but some of the plants coming back are different.
There's certain areas where it burned more severely, and there things are not coming back to look the same as they were before. So we are getting some novel grasses coming in. They're things that come in the boreal forest, and they're usually a transient stage in succession, so they may disappear after 20 years. But I guess of some concern perhaps for folks who think about caribou, we haven't seen much recovery of lichen yet at all, and I think that will take a lot longer.
Bratt-Hart says the charred tundra also became more subject to permafrost thawing.
During the period that immediately following the fire, when the surface is black, a lot of radiation was absorbed by the soil, and that's caused the local thermokarsting, the melting of subsurface ice, to occur not everywhere, but some places. And the impact of those thermokarsts on the aquatic environment is actually quite profound because of all the sediment and nutrients that it dumps into the aquatic system. So I think the aquatic systems are going to take longer to come back.
Climate warming is blamed for an increase in the occurrence of lightning that's making North Slope tundra more vulnerable to wildfire. Another presenter at yesterday's Arctic Research Commission meeting, UAF Reindeer Program Manager Greg Finstead, talked about efforts to revive Alaska's reindeer ranching business as a means to improving the economy and life in rural Alaska. Finstead says reindeer meat is prized for its health qualities and taste, giving the industry great potential.
Because right now it's an upside down industry. We have a market that is begging for the product. They say we will pay you anything if you can get us this product. And so it's actually a good situation to be in.
Alaska's commercial reindeer herds used to number 600,000 animals in the 20s and 30s, but today's herders graze about 15 to 20,000 reindeer across ranges in northwest Alaska. Federal legislation passed in 1937 limits reindeer herding to Alaska natives. Finstead says the UAF program is trying to help villagers grow the industry.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for over 50 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. Crowley.com.
Tea Party members and candidates the group support question if certain federal government programs are constitutionally sound, whether or not Social Security, unemployment, Medicare, and education should be under the purview of the federal system makes for a lively debate. To get some perspective, we've turned to two legal scholars. First, we'll hear from constitutional law professor Randy Barnett from Georgetown University. Barnett says even though the Supreme Court has said the programs are constitutional, candidates can and should question the basis for those decisions.
Every congressman and every senator takes an oath to uphold the Constitution. He or she does not take an oath to uphold what the Supreme Court opinion is about the Constitution. And what's so interesting about this is that most of the Supreme Court decisions that uphold these kinds of laws are basically deferring to Congress's judgment that what it's doing is constitutional. So it's perfectly appropriate for these senators and elected representatives to themselves independently decide what's within their constitutional powers, because that's what the Supreme Court is deferring to.
How easy would it be for lawmakers to challenge the basis for these types of services once the Supreme Court has ruled on them?
Well, that's not what's being proposed. I don't take it that they're challenging anything. They'd have to go to court to do that. They're basically just saying that they'll either enact laws that they think are constitutional or repeal laws that they think are unconstitutional, and that's totally within their power. I mean, think about the presidential veto. The president can veto a law because he thinks it's bad policy, but he can also veto a law because he thinks it's unconstitutional. In fact, he should, because he has taken an oath to uphold the Constitution as well. And his opinion about that doesn't depend on what the Supreme Court thinks. That's his own opinion.
And what are your thoughts generally about this new wave of political involvement in the country? What do you think it will mean in the future for how the country is governed?
Well, it's very interesting that the American people always seem to when they're strongly opposed to what's happening in Washington, they always seem to resort to looking and reading the Constitution of the United States, which we're lucky is in writing, so they can read it and see what it says and have their own opinion about what it says. And now we're seeing a lot of political action by ordinary private citizens who have their views of what the Constitution means, and they're now supporting elected candidates who have their views about what the Constitution means. And that is how constitutional law has evolved over the decades, by political action of this kind affecting how elected public officials like senators and congressmen view the meaning of the Constitution.
That was legal scholar Professor Randy Barnett from Georgetown University. Now for a slightly different take on this constitutional issue, we'll turn to the West Coast and hear from Professor Erwin Shimerinsky, who is the founding dean of the University of California Irvine School of Law. Shimerinsky says the constitutionality of these federal program issues have been settled law for seven decades.
The United States Supreme Court has made clear since the mid-1930s that Congress has broad power to regulate commerce among the states, and has specifically said this includes the ability to have minimum wage and maximum hour laws. The Supreme Court has said since the mid-1930s that Congress has the power, under its taxing and spending power, to create things like Social Security and things like the Department of Education. There is no constitutional doubt whatsoever now that these are permissible. Now, of course, these are based on Supreme Court interpretations of the Constitution. The Constitution doesn't explicitly mention these things, but the Constitution is just several pages long. It was meant to be an outline for government. I think there is 0% chance that the United States Supreme Court would declare Social Security or the Department of Education or minimum wage unconstitutional.
The health care legislation that passed, a court in Michigan found that the individual mandate is constitutional. What do you think this says about the challenges that are coming forward and the possibility that they will be heard?
I think it is important to separate that which is clearly established as a matter of constitutional law from that which is uncertain. It's clearly established that Social Security or the Department of Education or the minimum wage law are constitutional. It's obviously uncertain at this point as to what's going to happen in terms of the constitutionality of the federal health care bill. My own sense is, under the clearly established law, courts will rule that this is constitutional, But it's going to be a while before that gets to the Supreme Court.
What are your thoughts generally about this new wave of political involvement in the country? What do you think it will mean in the future for how our country is governed?
I think more political involvement is always good. I think people paying attention to the Constitution is always good. But what really bothers me is when people try to take their own policy preferences and put it in constitutional terms when there's no basis in constitutional law. So those who oppose Social Security certainly are free to do so. But to say that there's a chance that Social Security is declared unconstitutional is just nonsense. People can oppose the idea of a minimum wage, but to say that there's a chance that the minimum wage were declared unconstitutional, that's just nonsense.
Professor Erwin Chemerinsky is a constitutional law professor at the University of California Irvine School of Law. The State Department of Transportation and Public Facilities will be holding public hearings to see how residents of Western Alaska feel about the prospect of a road from the interior to Nome. Meadow Bailey is a spokeswoman with DOT. She says the state study has a preferred alternative for what's called the Yukon River Corridor.
And it's a route about 500 miles long. It starts, you know, runs loosely along the Yukon River and ends in Nome.
Bailey says the estimated cost to build a transportation corridor would be between $2.3 and $2.7 billion. The hearings will be held on Monday morning in White Mountain and Monday afternoon in Koyuk. On Tuesday, meetings are scheduled for Elam and Shaktulik, and on Wednesday, Unalakleet and Nome. Bailey says next week's meeting schedule is the first round and will take comments and gather more information.
And that's part of what this study would be doing, and that's actually going out in the field more, doing some more analysis, and being able to refine what the potential cost might be.
Bailey says it's not certain the road will be built at all. She says in researching the concept, DOT workers found documentation going back nearly 100 years. But she says the idea is to see if it's desired and makes economic sense. The prospect of a road access could mean increased economic opportunities.
But we also recognize that there are some people who choose to live where they live because there is not road access. And so it's important that we be able to talk to those people too and get their input.
DOT will also take email comments. Links to more information and maps are at our website, aprn.org. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Ben Stanton in Kenai, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Shane Iverson in Bethel, Matt Lichtenstein in Petersburg, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by NMS, building a culture of safety through active caring. More information online at nmsusa.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. A fisheries degree prepares you for a career in fisheries biology, management, business or policy, and more. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.